Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
Welcome to Virginia Conversations. I'm May Lily Lee. Today we're wrapping up 2012 with a look back at several of our favorite interviews since we first went on air in August. So put your telephone aside this hour and enjoy these encore conversations, beginning with former Virginia Attorney General Mary Sue Terry. The woman who broke through the governmental glass ceiling in the Old Dominion, Mary Sue Terry was born in Southside, Virginia, and earned her law degree from the University of Virginia. She was elected to the House of Delegates in the late 70s, and in 1985, Terry made a successful run, winning the race for Attorney General, becoming the first woman ever elected to statewide office in Virginia. It's just one part of her long history in government and public service. Here's Connie Stevens with this career profile.
It wasn't overnight political fame for the Martinsville-born Mary Sue Terry, rather a lifelong love of civics that began in her girlhood. Her passion for politics led her to become one of only two students in her tiny graduating class of 36 who would go on to college and complete a four-year degree. Then came a master's in government, followed by a law degree and decades of work in public office and service. Long known as a trailblazer, she makes an impassioned call to her fellow females to find and earn a seat at the table.
Virginia needs you. We are a twin-engine plane that's been operating for over 200 years on principally one engine. Can you imagine what it would be like if we get the other started?
But let's go back to what preceded that speech at a conference at the University of Virginia Center for Politics 6 years ago. In 1978, Mary Sue Terry joined the Virginia House of Delegates and worked as the Assistant Commonwealth Attorney in Patrick County. She got the job as the state's top prosecutor in 1985 and was reelected to the AG job again 4 years later. Her office successfully argued 8 out of 10 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. She worked to reform insurance rates and firmed up drunk driving legislation. She rewrote laws on waste management and clean water. She's been a champion of the consumer, still remembered for negotiating a nationwide recall of defective ambulances. By the end of the 1980s, she was ready to run for governor, but instead deferred to fellow Democrat Doug Wilder. He went on to become the first African-American governor in the nation. Throughout it all, Mary Sue Terry has pressed more than her share of Commonwealth flesh.
Thank you. I was there last week.
Thank you for coming. I enjoyed your talk.
Thank you. You at the high school?
Yes.
Talk with my cousin Tommy?
This audio goes back to her 1993 visit to the Virginia Education Association in Richmond, where the issue of the day was guns in the classroom.
My first educational priority will be to get guns out of our public schools. We need to make our schools safe, so that our teachers can teach and our students can learn.
That was the year she made her bid for governor, running against Republican Congressman George Allen. The campaign, though, ended with her disappointment. Here's political analyst Stuart Rothenberg commenting on C-SPAN, November 2nd, 1993.
She started off as the candidate who was the conservative, or at least the moderate Democrat. She started off as the political outsider, primarily because she was a woman. And she started out allegedly as a candidate who had the advantage on the all-important crime issue, because she was the attorney general. All of those turned around. Allen portrayed her as a liberal. He ran as a tough, down-the-line conservative. He portrayed her as part of the problem, part of the establishment.
Tonight, with disappointment in the result, I have respect and admiration for Virginians who issued their verdict. Tonight, we turn a new page in our Commonwealth's history. I ask you all to turn that page with me. To remember this campaign was a campaign that was more than a campaign. It was a cause.
And the causes continue for Terry. These days she lives on her family farm in Patrick County and continues to practice law. A few years ago she formed a political action committee called the Farm Team, dedicated to helping Democratic women seek elected office, the seat at the table with a full place setting. I'm Connie Stevens reporting.
And now Mary Sue Terry joins us by phone from her home in Patrick County. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, May Lily. I was listening to the prologue. It brought back a lot of memories, but of course, you know, that was a long time ago.
Well, I'd like to get to that. In fact, I particularly liked your comment about turning that page with me.
It was a page for me personally. It was a page for George Allen, and it was a page for well.
Before we launch into that, I want to get a snapshot of where you are. You're on your family's farm in Patrick County, over 500 acres. Do you mind giving us a visual idea of your setting there?
Well, I live now in the house I grew up in, which was built by my parents in the early 50s. It's situated so that, except for one small slice, everything I see is part of the family farm that's been in the family since just after the Civil War. I'm looking out right now at a horse barn, which has now been converted into a little calf hospital, and pastures. Down below me is the mill. My great-grandfather founded Cooper's Mill in 1873, which makes it somewhat older than Mabry's Mill on the Parkway. But unlike Mabry's Mill, it's fallen into decline. There's just a lot of history here. But at the same time, for the last number of years, I've been in the process, with the permission of my sisters and their help, of trying to transform this farm into a vibrant and attractive cattle farm.
You warned us that during the course of our interview we might hear some cows mooing or a vehicle or two.
We could hear the dog bark if someone pulls up in the driveway or one of my kittens scratching at the door. I don't know what we'll hear.
You're a homebody then.
Yes, I am. I never dreamed when I was living in Richmond that I would ever return to the farm. But somewhere along about the year 2000, as I was looking around Richmond for a house that was as small as the house I lived in, which was a very comfortable house, but had a larger yard, there wasn't one that I could afford. And then I thought to myself, you know, Mary Sue, you've got this, you and your sisters have this property in Patrick County. And the wheels started turning, and finally one day I called my sister Sally Ann, who's an elementary school principal in Henry County, which is just across the line, and I said, Sally Ann, how would you feel if I moved back to the farm? And her jaw dropped. But it's just been a wonderful experience to be on the farm, but also to be close to family.
Now, earlier with Connie Stevens' prologue, you mentioned that you had a reaction to that. What were some of the thoughts going through your mind as you heard some of the sound bites from the past?
Well, you know, it's been almost 20 years since the election for governor. And I lived about 8 years after that in Richmond, with clearly a different lifestyle. And then I've been on the farm now 11 years, and I have refocused. And it was a really good feeling to hear Connie's piece, and it because she used some sound bites from previous occasions that I spoke. It brought me back to that period, which was a wonderful time in my life. But one of the things that I've learned, and that is when adversity comes and you are able at the end of a transition, however painful it might be, and you're moving forward, you come out of that, and I came out of that in a different and better place. And so the gift that I had from the beginning after the loss of the governor's race was I knew my political career was over. not my public service, but my political career. And I never had a hankering to run again. And that was the real gift. So I didn't know exactly what I was going to do, but life has just unfolded.
And I guess my thought around that is that you have people like George Allen, who suffers a macaca moment, but rises again and reenters politics. Why did you know that down the line there wouldn't be another reemergence into politics?
Well, I looked at over time. I looked at my age. Well, first of all, you know, I really was beaten very badly and hurt in the governor's race, and. But I looked at my life, and I look at my life now, and you just kind of compute, on average, the viable years left in your life. Regrettably, in Virginia, we only have a one-term governor. And a governor's race, to be done well, takes a couple of years. And running for election is a lot like planning an outdoor wedding. You know, you can plan the most fabulous outdoor wedding in the world, but if it rains, you're not going to have an outdoor wedding unless you have a tent. You know, in politics, you can be prepared. You can believe that you're the best qualified. You can get your message out, but if the climate is such that people just aren't comfortable with your party and they're not comfortable with incumbency, you find yourself in a terrific headwind. And in 1993, that's exactly what happened. The president, who was a great president, Bill Clinton, was having problems. Our governor was having problems. Some other folks were having problems. And when I ran for governor of Virginia, because the Democratic Party was, let's put it this way, in bad odor, more so than in the recent past, I was never able to invite in any national Democratic figure. Al Gore and I were good friends at the time, but if I'd invited him in, then the question was, why didn't you invite the president in? And regardless of my high personal regard for President Clinton, it was just not the wise thing to do at that time. So to contemplate spending a couple of years preparing for a race and then moving toward an election with the prospect that so many things are out of your control, you know, has an appeal to me. And at this stage in my life, while I feel better about myself and my capabilities than I ever have before, I'm realistic about my viable years ahead, and I just wouldn't want to spend whatever the percentage is back doing something that was wonderful to do 20 and 30 years ago, but it's just not where I am now.
Emily from Charlottesville has a comment. Go ahead, Emily.
Yes, hi, thank you so much. My question is, have you found that women from the Democratic or Republican Party typically meet with more success in being elected?
I'm sorry, typically meet with more success than what?
Emily, will you rephrase your question for us?
Yes, sure. Have you found that Democratic women or Republican women generally meet with more success when trying to get elected at the state or national level?
Okay. Well,
okay, so your question is which party tends to fare better for women? Is that the question?
Sure.
Okay.
Oh, okay. I really believe it boils down to how a Democratic woman or a Republican woman positions themselves, number one, and secondly, the complexion of their districts. When I first ran for the House of Delegates back in 1977, I was 29 at the time. I'd never run for public office. I knew, and I was running in a very large district geographically, I knew that unless I could relate to enough people one-on-one and have them call me by my first name, as opposed to that woman who's running from Patrick, I would never have a chance unless I could get a number of people who felt comfortable calling me by my first name. I think that women have advantages. I mean, clearly, a Republican woman who's in a very, very conservative district is going to be well positioned to win. But let's just take a competitive district, one that's where the voters are split between the two. I think an awful lot has to do with the interpersonal skills, the candidate's ability to listen, the candidate's knowledge of public policy, and ability to raise money. So I think all of those matter really more than the party if you're in a competitive district.
We're with Mary Sue Terry, former Attorney General, and I think you've provided a great segue to the Farm Team, which you co-founded back in 2008. Tell us about that mission.
Well, I was fortunate enough to be approached after giving a speech in March of 2008 by Susan Platt and Mame Riley, who were two leaders in the Democratic Party. And I was asked if I would consider having some women down on the farm to talk about what we could do to elect more women to statewide office. And I said, of course. They did all the work, and in September, actually it was 4 years ago this month, cars started pulling up in my driveway and my yard, and I believe there were 23 women from all parts of the Commonwealth. And we started on a Friday night and kind of brainstormed some, and then the next day we broke out into groups. And by the end of the day, we were on our farm. The sort of double entendre of the Farm Team emerged as the name of the organization that has developed over the last 4 years. And unlike men, women typically need to be asked to run for public office. Secondly, they need to be helped to be the best candidate they can be, and that can involve how they present themselves. Ann Richards once said in the group, your hair's got to look good. Someone else said, you got to have the right shoes. They can't look clunky. But they're just all kinds of aesthetic things that go into a candidate presenting herself well.
On Virginia Public Radio today, our guest is former Attorney General Mary Sue Terry. Coming up, retired Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North in just a moment. You're listening to a special Where Are They Now edition of Virginia Conversations. Mention Oliver North, and his supporters conjure up an image of a spit-shined warrior carrying out the orders of his commander-in-chief with determination and dedication. And his military record supports that image, a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, 22 years in the Marine Corps, rising to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel and the recipient of the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, and two Purple Hearts. North entered the national spotlight as a key witness in the Iran-Contra congressional hearings in 1987. During that time, North was on the National Security Council staff at the White House. Yet North says his most important role in his life is to be, quote, the husband of one, the father of four, and the grandfather of 12. Welcome, Oliver North.
Hey, Lily. Good to be with you. Thank you.
Let's talk about the past, and we will talk about, you know, where are you now in just a moment. But first, this is the 25th year anniversary of the Iran-Contra affair, which involved the clandestine sale of weapons to Iran and served to encourage the release of hostages from Lebanon. You were the architect of the second part of the plan to sell arms to Iran at a markup price, take the profit, and divert it to the Contras in Nicaragua. Now, the American public viewed the Contras as freedom fighters back then, and there you were facing congressional inquisition, which could have gone either way, but thousands of letters came in supporting you. Tell us how you felt at the time. Were you fearful for maybe prison time? Were you confident that nothing like that would occur? Or,
well, there were certainly people who wanted to put me there. There's no doubt about that. The special prosecutor, which that long ordeal was responsible for doing away with that legislation, where special prosecutors could act with impunity and without, quite frankly, any constitutional constraints whatsoever. Good news in all of that is I was confident throughout the entirety of it, not just the hearings that began 25 years ago this year, but the trials that went on for years afterwards. People forget there were 5 years of trials that went on, not just for me, but for others as well. Thankfully, mine ended well when it was sent up to appeal by the Supreme Court. They sent it back and said, you can't do this. And that's how it ended for most people, despite the 40-some-odd million dollars that the special prosecutor spent. I think the positive outcome from all that is, one, a democratic outcome was achieved in Nicaragua. Number two, Americans were released by the Iranians who controlled the Lebanese terrorists who held them. And ultimately, that legislation that was so unconstitutional was voted down, and we ended up with, I hope, a better system of justice for those kinds of things that, quite frankly, become very political. Ronald Reagan was a very conservative president. It was a very liberal Congress at the time. They tried to criminalize those policy differences, and thankfully that, I think, is pretty much gone by the boards.
It's interesting to watch what happened to the Boland Amendment prohibiting taking U.S. aid and giving it to those who would want to unearth the government there. And yet, while it was in place at one point, there were millions and millions of dollars legally given to Contras.
Hundreds of millions, yeah. Actually, the program actually began in the Carter administration. I joined the White House under the Reagan administration in July of 1981, and the program to support the Nicaraguan resistance had already begun. It was funded initially under Carter. It became a very big issue because I think people, again, tend to forget. At the time, you had the Soviets occupying Afghanistan. You had 22 countries that had succumbed in one fashion or another to revolution supported by the Soviets. There really was an evil empire, as Ronald Reagan described it. And the outcome in Nicaragua was going to determine whether there was going to be a revolution without frontiers pushed all through Central America and maybe up into Mexico. And so the program that was administered by the CIA was restricted right from almost the very beginning. Eddie Boland was the chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, and the Democrats basically owned and operated the government in the legislative branch of our Congress. And the most restrictive of the Boland covenants was that, and I think I can almost quote it still 25 years later, no funds made available by this act, which was the Defense Appropriations Bill, may be used for the purposes or which would have the effect of providing direct or indirect support for military or paramilitary operations or activities against the Sandinista government. And that was the one passed in 1984 that precipitated, okay, there's got to be some other way. President Reagan's instructions were, keep the Contras together, body and soul. Interestingly enough, earlier this year, May Lilly, the man who was responsible for administering all of that in Nicaragua, Adolfo Calero, passed away at age 84 in Managua, a place that he had to flee from and lose all his property when the Sandinistas took over in 1979.
Now, the outcome of your trial was no prison time. 3 years suspended prison term, 2 years probation, and 1,200 hours of community service. Did that seem unjust to you?
And then it was reversed on appeal. I mean, all of that was abrogated. Well, no. I mean, I was very assured right from the very beginning of this process that it was going to turn out okay. Now, part of that's my spiritual perspective on life, and part of it was a magnificent legal team headed by Brendan Sullivan at the law firm of Williams & Connolly. And Brendan put together a legal team that for 5 years did nothing but my case. Would have been astronomically expensive. It would have been impossible for me to have paid the legal bills, but for the American people who became so generous as a consequence of the hearings. And that and writing a very successful book and several others thereafter. But I never lacked confidence that it was going to ultimately turn out okay in the end. I mean, I would much rather have not have gone through all that. All I ever really wanted to be was a Marine and a husband, a dad, and now a granddad. I also believe you shouldn't go back and play the game of shoulda, woulda, coulda, because it can drive you crazy. You get yourself back up, move on, and in my case, moved off to several other different adventures. I certainly have had a very exciting life.
And we're going to talk about that in a moment, too. I want to fast forward to 1994 and your run for U.S. Senate. Interestingly, Senator John Warner endorsed Marshall Coleman, an independent, in that race. How did you feel about his betrayal here?
Well, you got the right word, because before I declared, I sat down with Bob Dole, who was then the majority leader of the U.S. Senate, and Bob Dole and I walked over to John Warner's office, and John Warner pledged right there in front of both of us that he would stay out of the race, that he was not going to endorse me, but he was not going to interfere. And then he subsequently recruited Marshall Coleman to run as an independent. As long as there were four people in the race, Doug Wilder, Chuck Robb, Oliver North, and Marshall Coleman, I was ahead. And then Doug Wilder was convinced by then-President Clinton to drop out of the race, that he was going to get some great ambassadorial post. And Doug, he and I had a lot of fun in the campaign. We had a lot of great debates. We'd see each other, I think, at every county fair in Virginia. He used to just love to stick it to Robb. He called me up the night before he withdrew. In Virginia, you have to pull out 45 days before the election. He called me up and said, I don't want you to read this in the Washington Post tomorrow, but I'm withdrawing tomorrow. And I said, if that happens, I'll drop behind. He said, I know, that's why I'm dropping out. I said, Clinton had offered him some great opportunity that I don't think he actually fulfilled, but the end result was that Coleman took just enough votes that Rob beat me by, 2%, I think, across the state.
At the eve of the election, there was a surprise spokesperson, Nancy Reagan, who was no friend to you.
No, John Warner convinced her to come out and say ugly things, and it didn't help. I don't think that carried the election one way or the other at that point. I think it was, as long as you had three people in the race, two of whom were pulling from the Republican base, it was pretty much a foregone conclusion, notwithstanding what Dan Rather said the night of the election, that it looked like I was going to win. I think we had a very, very good polling operation going, and it showed I was going to lose by about 2%, and I think that's what the ultimate outcome was.
This comment, which she made, seemed to be from the past. It was that her husband had no knowledge of what you were doing in the 80s.
Well, as I said in various tribunals that existed from essentially November of 1986 all the way through the final trials in 1992, everything that I did, I was authorized to do, and everything that I was authorized to do, I did. And those words were repeated by Admiral John Poindexter in his trial and in mine. And Admiral Poindexter was National Security Advisor, one of four for President Reagan.
We should talk about that. You have such a broad spectrum. People associate your name with Iran-Contra, and yet you were involved in the planning of the rescue of 800 med students in Grenada. You helped plan the 1986 raid on Muammar Gaddafi. In fact, there was a special thank you from Gaddafi. Tell us about that.
Well, what Gaddafi did is he authorized Abu Nidal, who was a terrorist then working for Gaddafi, to take out my family and me in February of 1987. An organization called the People's Committee for Libyan Students, which was being tracked very closely by the FBI and what I think we euphemistically correctly refer to, without me getting into problems with classified information, with technical services, detected the order to come in. They watched them go to a self-storage unit, take out RPGs, hand grenades, AK-47s, and head to our house. The FBI had alerted us. They'd taken us out of town, actually brought us to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, which we can say now, and hid us out down there. When we moved back in, they'd arrested them. Then they were released because the FBI did not want the U.S. attorney, who was then Henry Hudson, now a federal judge in Richmond, to divulge how they knew that the terrorists were coming to our house, six of them.
Had your family already become inured to that kind of threat, or was this really a big deal to them for the first time?
My wife really did not know the full measure of what I did. I mean, she found at one point one of my alias passports and asked me what was going on. Again, I was a U.S. Marine. Most U.S. Marines do not carry alias passports with their picture in it and another name on it, or passports from other countries. We had a secure phone in our home. We had, and she knew that I traveled on very short notice all over the world. It was a different time. Quite frankly, I do not know any other wife or mother who's ever had to flee because bad people were coming to her home to kill her, her children, because of what her husband had done. And so I have an enormous amount of regard and respect for her courage and faithfulness, quite frankly. I mean, most husbands put their wives through something like that, probably end up looking for another wife.
That's a good segue to today. You are obviously proud of your family. Tell me, a couple of them are in Virginia, Central Virginia.
All of them are back in Virginia. We got two of them down in Charlottesville, and we've got one in Northern Virginia. Hopefully, we're going to end up with two more grandchildren here in the not-too-distant future. So.
Right, when I asked you about the number of grandchildren, you did fine-tune that for me,
12.8. 12.8.
And since 2001, you've been hosting the Fox News Channel show War Stories. Tell us about that.
Still traveling all over the world. And the great blessing in all of that is that I get to keep company with heroes. That's all I do. My only beat for Fox News is soldiers, sailors, airmen, guardsmen, Marines, and law enforcement. I go all over the world with them. I get to do things that others don't, in large part because I speak the language and they know it. The young Americans that we've got out there at the front lines of freedom get it. And they know that I'm not going to go out there and, unlike some of our colleagues in the media, I'm not going to go out and divulge things that are going to put them at greater risk than they're already in. I get to go on operations with Navy SEALs and Marine Special Operators and Army Spec Ops, and in faraway places that are often challenging. I have a couple of moments when I've begun to think that trying to keep up with a 25-year-old at my advanced age and decrepitude is probably not wise. But I've also got a wonderful sound bite from a Marine gunner at one point as I am running to keep up with a sergeant from an explosive ordnance disposal, and I'm keeping up with him. And the Marine gunner commented, "It's amazing how fast an old man can move when he's properly motivated."
Well, you know, lest anyone think that the colonel is a Philistine, you have three military novels, military thriller novels, under your belt, and yet a fourth coming out now.
Fourth one coming out for Heroes Proved, a stanza from a wonderful song called America the Beautiful. You know, Mark Twain, I think it was asked, why did he write about the things he does? And he said, you have to write about the things you know. And that's what I do. I get to tell the tales of these remarkable young Americans with whom I've been able to keep company now for 40-some-odd years. I do keep company with heroes, and I write books about them. both nonfiction and fiction. In this case, I've learned that if you change enough of the dates, times, places, and names, you can create your own quotes. And if you don't like one of the characters, you can kill them off. And the good guys don't necessarily have to lose. So fiction writing is a lot of fun. In many respects, it's easier than nonfiction because you do have to make sure in nonfiction that everything has got the quotes in the right places and the times and dates. But nonfiction books is about the youngsters who've been fighting this war now for better than a decade, reflect enormous credit on their parents and this country. You know, a lot of people talk about, well, can Generation X or Generation Y stand up to the kinds of rigors that you expect in difficult and dangerous places? And they do. I had the pleasure of serving as a young Marine officer in a place called Vietnam, in an era where the leaders of the country were referred to by David Halberstam as the brightest and best. Well, I've gotten to cover the best and bravest of this generation in now 11 years of this war.
I want to thank you so much, Colonel Oliver North, for joining us today. You're listening to a special Where Are They Now edition of Virginia Conversations. There's more to come following this quick break. And this is Virginia Conversations. Thanks for joining us today. He may have been born in D.C., but John Warner is a Virginian through and through. A graduate of Washington and Lee and the University of Virginia, Warner served in the Navy as World War II came to a close, as a Marine during the Korean War, and later as Secretary of the Navy during the Vietnam War. In the mid-70s, Warner served as administrator for the American Revolution Bicentennial Administration, coordinating the celebration of our nation's 200th birthday. It was in that bicentennial year of 1976, public servant John Warner made public entertainment news, becoming Elizabeth Taylor's sixth husband. Warner was first elected to the U.S. Senate in 1978. During his five terms, he served on the Senate Armed Services Committee, including three stints as chairman. Retiring from public service after 30 years in the Senate, Warner had become the second longest-serving U.S. senator in state history. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, I feel very humbled that you would take the time to talk to the old boy.
Where are you calling us from?
Actually, right now in the office of the Pew Trust, that's one of my principal clients, and I do a lot of work on energy and the environment, which interests me a great deal, and we just concluded a meeting here on that. So this was a convenient time to get to you, and here we are.
I'd like to take you back to 1999 when you became the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, and that lasted all the way through 2007. But in your first years as chairman, there was the Kosovo War, the Iraq disarmament crisis, and of course in 2001, 9/11 happened. Were these defining years for you as chairman?
Very much so, because I worked closely with the president and the senior members of Congress, and the wars just engulfed so much of our activities in the Congress at that time. Particularly the Armed Services Committee was totally supported by the men and women of the armed forces, and once the president made decisions, we gave that support. And the involvement of the Security Council of the United Nations, and in other words, working with our global partners. You've got to remember that the United States' basic defense policy is predicated on global participation in trying to preserve freedom. And I commend the first president, George Bush. He put together the 12 or so nations that repelled Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. And then the second, George Bush, and then, of course, President Clinton. I worked very closely with him. We were the leader of the global community, very much so in the lead with others to preserve freedom.
Now, a lot of people may not remember, because your 30-year career as senator may have overshadowed this, but you did serve as Secretary of the Navy. Which role was most rewarding to you, being a senator or being the Navy Secretary?
Well, I was Undersecretary, Secretary of the Navy for over 5 years. It was one of the longer periods for an individual to stay in those offices that long. But I enjoyed it. It was a tremendous challenge. It was during a tragic chapter in American military history, the war in Vietnam, because we had the bravery of our forces engaged in that war matched the bravery that men and women have shown that have worn the uniform since our republic was formed. But the Vietnam War was one that was not fully supported here on the home front. Unlike World War II, to somewhat lesser extent, the Korean conflict. But there was a lot of dissension. And unfortunately, the men and women in uniform, particularly sadly when they returned from the battlefronts, were not as warmly greeted back home as my generation was in World War II and in the Korean conflict.
And I want to ask you about World War II in just a second, but would you say that while you were serving in your Senate years that you looked back fondly on your role as Navy Secretary, or even maybe wished that you were doing that again?
Well, I would simply say, I don't in any way claim to be an American hero, certainly not in terms of my wearing the uniform. I did exactly what was expected of a young sailor, 17, turned 18, and I think I was 19 when I left the Navy. It was the final year of World War II. At that time, we had no expectation that the war would end so quickly, but it did. Then in the Korean War, I was a young officer with the Marines, and I did spend a period in Korea. But those experiences were a privilege for me, and they laid the foundations, as if you were building a building, the footings that go in and get the permanency of the structure. Those privileged opportunities to serve with and learn from your fellow sailors and Marines, in my case, was just invaluable in putting together such a career as I did in the years to follow.
Now take us to World War II. You were 17 years old. Why did you decide to enlist then?
Well, you've got to remember that a young 17-year-old in World War II, first place, you were living in your own villages and communities. You didn't, your family basically, as a consequence of the Depression in the 30s, and so forth, we didn't have a lot of travel. We lived in the community. We knew our communities. And when they put that poster up, join the Navy and see the world, it was a very exciting challenge. And all the 17-year-old boys on my block, we just couldn't wait to enlist and go on and join our older brothers and a few instances sisters and the fellows on the block that had served and come back. And then, of course, sadly, on my block, I can still close my eyes and remember the doors. You put up a gold star if you'd lost a son in that war, and it was right there for all to see on the block, that gold star. Then there was a little placard that was put up, proudly, my son or our children or one of them are in this Navy and Marines or whatever it was. The whole of the country was united together in World War II. Not only those of us in uniform, but back on the home front. When I tell my children, they're all grown now, but I used to try and explain, we had gas rationing, food rationing, clothing rationing, all sorts of things, but the community of people in your villages and towns and cities across this country and on the farmlands of America, we were all united in one effort to preserve the freedom of this country.
I want to fast forward, if I may, and go to the mid-70s. You met Elizabeth Taylor, and you were married to her for 6 years. Now, this was before you had become a U.S. senator.
That's correct.
What was going on in your life then?
Well, actually, it was rather interesting. One of my jobs in the Bicentennial, which was a fascinating opportunity for me to, I visited every state in the United States to promote and provide some federal funding to have their own programs of choice individually in the state. Federal government, I said flatly, will not dictate or dominate how each state wishes to celebrate the 200th anniversary. You can understand Virginia, where the founding fathers and others emanated. There were many exciting celebrations. But then you'd go to the far west, where places were joined the Union much later and so forth. It was less emphasis. But anyway, it worked out beautifully. And I also traveled to 22 different foreign nations in connection with their gifts to America in recognition of our 200th anniversary. So it was a very broadening experience. And that, too, contributed to the foundation, my excitement, to try and become a member of Congress. Each of the heads of the 22 states that gave gifts visited the United States, and the president would receive them, and I would be a part of the ceremonies, you know, help organizing it. The last visitor was the Queen, and as a part of her guest list was Elizabeth. And I sort of had a blind date with Elizabeth when the Queen gave a party at the British Embassy to honor our President, Vice President, Secretary of State, and so forth. There were 100 people there. I'll never forget the night, and was very cordial, and she loved to see the Virginia countryside, and I allowed her, and I'd be happy to escort her around, because Virginia reminded her so much of her beloved England. And so eventually it did work into a marriage, and I have remained good friends with her and talked with her till shortly before she passed on, could no longer really have conversations. And yes, we did split up, but we didn't do it in anger. We did it in reality that she wanted to go back and make movies and be on the theater all over the world, and I was in the U.S. Senate, and I couldn't be actively a husband in various parts of the world at the same time. So we had a friendly parting, but we saw each other on occasion after that on a number of times and always conversed at various periods of the year, Christmas and our birthdays and so forth. And she really was an extraordinary person.
During those years of your marriage from 76 to 82, do you feel that she did acclimate to Washington life but just wanted something else?
No, she didn't really like it. I mean, the Senate runs on its own schedule. You never know when you're going to get home for dinner. In those days, anyway, you didn't know whether you'd have to work on the weekends, and she did like to plan and do things. And so she just, about two-thirds of the way through our marriage, I guess it was the fourth or fifth year or something, she said, you know, I've just got to go back and do what I know how to do best and enjoy the most. And so she started on the stage, her first entry, and then in more movies. And I would try and fly over and participate and see her and then fly back. And so that was how we had a good life together. And we both looked back on it and reflected with gratefulness and pride and many times in conversations after we parted.
She strikes fans as generous and warm-hearted.
Well, she had a big heart. She really did. She had a fiery temper, but she had a big heart.
Now, I also like to take you up to 94. In 1994, you chose not to endorse your Republican Party mate, Oliver North, in his run for Senate. And as our listeners know, instead you backed Marshall Coleman, the independent candidate. North and other Republicans, of course, were deeply disappointed to not receive this endorsement. Talk to us about why you didn't tap North.
Well, Coleman had served in public office in Virginia. I knew him quite well. I frankly didn't know North that well. It wasn't that I tried to block North. I just had to make a choice between different people vying for the Republican nomination. And I decided to back Marshall, as I had worked with him while he was in public office. I knew him. I didn't have an animosity against Oliver North. Oliver North was a very distinguished Marine. He had a wonderful record of service, public service in the Marine Corps, But there were other aspects of his life which I, when he served as in the administration and various things that he did, I felt perhaps, you know, he had a split with Ronald Reagan. I've been always a great supporter of Ronald Reagan's. So anyway, that was a parting of the ways, but I really decided, and I am free to do that, support Marshall Coleman, and that I did.
Do you feel that you paid a price in a way that fellow Republicans felt that you couldn't endorse those in your own party?
Well, certain elements of the party backed Marshall. Moore backed Oliver North. I would agree to that. When you say pay a price, let me tell you, in political life, every day, you have to make decisions. I always tried, and I think I fairly succeeded, to make decisions which I thought were in the best interest of our country, the best interests of Virginia, and then hopefully they coincided what I believe to be the best interest of the Republican Party. But there were times when there were deep issues and differences of opinion against what I did. But I was able to get, no other body in the Republican Party has done it, reelected 5 times. So I just stand on the record.
You know, it's interesting because while you might have not curried favor with some of your GOP mates because of that lack of endorsement, you knew how to take the next steps. There was another election coming up. It was time for you to be reseated. And as the incumbent, you had the option to choose either a Republican primary or a Republican caucus. And smartly, you picked the primary because you kind of felt, well, I don't think I'm going to survive the caucus and my peers. Is that sort of how it happened?
State law was very clear that an incumbent could make that choice. And I made the choice right in the beginning, because I like to have the broadest amount of support for my campaign, and you gained broader support by allowing anyone who so decided to go to the polls in that primary and cast a vote for or against me. So that gave an opportunity for all Virginians who are registered to cast a vote and express their opinion with regard to the sitting Senator John Warner. And it did give a tremendous opportunity for a lot of folks that frankly concentrated on politics only about election time, as opposed to party people who really work around the year. And we're fortunate that the two-party system is strong in Virginia. That's very, very important to our democracy, to have a strong two-party system.
The strategy worked because you did defeat your Republican rival James Miller for the nomination.
Well, Jim Miller was a very competent, able fellow. But he really he had not had any experience, you know, in the hustings and running for a big election like that. But he gave it his best.
Now, as we've reiterated, you served 5 terms, 30
yeah.
years, which is absolutely remarkable. In these days of the Internet and social media and winds changing favor at every day, do you think that today's lawmakers have an equal shot at that kind of longevity?
Frankly, I think that the era where you can get elected 5 consecutive times has been narrowed substantially. I remember just a few months ago the graciousness of the General Assembly of Virginia. Speaker Howell invited me down to join a fellow Washington and Lee classmate, Lacey Putney, who is the longest-serving member in Virginia history of the General Assembly in the House. He's the longest-serving. I was the longest-serving in the Senate, Republican, of course, but second to Harry Burge Sr. And it was quite a celebration that the General Assembly gave us there, just for a short time on the floor. But I reflected on just what you said, and I said in my remarks, I doubt ever again that the two persons will stand before you with such long careers in their respective bodies.
The time was right. The person was right. You made, as you talk about those decisions that you make on a daily basis, obviously you made the right ones.
Well, I think I probably did.
I want to talk a little bit about some social issues. You were considered pro-choice. And although you have also voted for some abortion restrictions, it is very rare for any Republican to be identified as in favor of a woman's choice.
Well, I'm not sure I'd use the word rare, but basically the conservative elements of the Republican Party feel very strongly on the issue. I just think each individual should be sort of free to make up his or her own mind on that. I value life greatly. On the other hand, I respect, and through the years I've really been strongly of the view that a woman has a special responsibility and a very special duty unto herself and her family and other loved ones and others to make the right decision which is best for herself. And therefore, I just think that you shouldn't put laws out there that take away that right from a woman.
You were also more moderate than most Republican senators from the South when it came to gun control laws. You voted for the Brady Bill. And in 1999, you were one of only five Republicans to vote to close the so-called gun show loophole.
Well, I did, because from my childhood, I never will forget, my father on my 12th birthday gave me a shotgun. And I was about the only kid on the block that had was given a gun. And my father said he would be. My father had been in World War One in the trenches as a doctor, and he was a soldier at heart, and he drilled into me the responsibility and accountability, which helped me in my careers in the Navy and in the Marine Corps. That is my period of time. And guns have been a part of my life. I had a large gun collection when I had a farm and used to hunt a lot. But I respect the right, the constitutional rights that people have. But again, I believe that we've got to, as a society, occasionally make some sacrifices to make the lifestyle of the others safer. And I do think that the gun situation has gotten to the point where there's such a proliferation of weapons. Guns are made for protection and for personal pleasure, as hunting and target shooting and other things. May that always be. But somehow we got to recognize that, unfortunately, there's an awful lot of trafficking among people who have literally no or much less responsibility towards the other fellow man or woman than do we.
I appreciate your shedding light on some of these issues. I want to be sure to get some time in to find out, what is John Warner doing now? What are you up to?
Well, I was fortunate to go back to a law firm where I'd started many, many years, 32 years ago, and I'm pretty much allowed to do as I please. I represent, as I said, I'm proudly representing the Pew Foundation on issues of energy. I'm concerned about energy, and energy has a direct relationship to our national security. And I love the environment and trying to preserve it as best we can for future generations. And I'm doing those things that I enjoy to do. I exercise 3 or 4 times a week, because that's very important when you become an octogenarian, to keep your body strong and your mind strong. And I sort of do what I want. I've got a lovely wife who cares for me and disciplines me quite properly to do this and do that, and take good care of myself. Children come by, I got grandchildren, so I have an enormous good fortune. And I just, when you talk about me, just always remember, I am humble. I am a lucky, lucky individual for all the marvelous opportunities that have been given me. I've gotten more of my share of good luck.
One of your staff members told us that you shy away from the limelight, and
absolutely
not what you're seeking.
I don't, not sure why I'm doing this, except I'm a great supporter of public television and public radio.
That's a great plug and a great way to wrap. A distinguished senator for 30 years and Secretary of the Navy, Senator John Warner. That's all the time we have for this encore edition of Virginia Conversations. Thanks for listening. We really do appreciate it. I'm May Lily Lee, wishing you a happy, healthy, and prosperous new year.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.